The following Aloud podcast was recorded live in 2008 at the historic Central Library in the heart of downtown LA as part of the award-winning Aloud series presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Aloud podcasts are made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arent Fox and by individual contributions from listeners like you. For more information on Aloud, or to find out how you, too, can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please visit our website, www.aloudla.org.
As the Washington Times noted, if only Peter Galbraith had been listened to in the first place. Mr. Galbraith is a leading authority on Iraq, and he's here tonight to discuss his new book, Unintended Consequences, How War in Iraq Strengthened America's Enemies. So we can test him out on what our candidates had to say. He is the architect of the partition plan that is considered the main alternative to Bush's Iraq strategy, and which has been endorsed by both Democratic and Republican presidential candidates and many members of Congress. He served as the first U.S. ambassador to Croatia, where he mediated the 1995 Ardut Agreement that ended the Croatia War. He's held senior positions in the United Nations. He's worked on Iraq for more than 25 years, having uncovered and documented the start of Saddam Hussein's genocide against the Kurds in 1987 and his use of chemical weapons in 1988. He was the author of the Senate-passed Prevention of Genocide Act of 1988 that would have imposed comprehensive sanctions on Iraq and was with the Kurdish rebels during their doomed 1991 uprising. The man knows whereof he speaks, and it will be a pleasure to hear him tonight with Mike Schuster, who is a diplomatic correspondent and roving foreign correspondent for NPR. We hear Mike's voice all over the world, from Georgia, from Iran. He's based here in NPR's Los Angeles Bureau, and when he's not traveling outside the U.S., he covers issues of nuclear nonproliferation and weapons of mass destruction, terrorism, and the Pacific Rim. And he's reported extensively from the Middle East, from all over the world, from Afghanistan, further afield, Pakistan, and India. Please welcome Mike Schuster and Peter K. Galbraith.
Peter, you need to pull this a little bit just towards you like this. That's it.
Good evening, everyone. Thanks, Louise, and thanks to the library for inviting me back to the Aloud program. The book, the subtitle of the book, is what I want to focus on, How War in Iraq Strengthened America's Enemies. Interestingly enough, one of the first chapters in Peter's book is titled Who Lost Iraq? And I think we ought to talk about Iraq first, and Peter, your view of it. You're nearly alone, I'd say, in terms of analysts to have concluded and declared in public that the Iraq war is lost. Why do you say that?
We've had a lot of talk, including this evening, about the surge, a description of it as a success. But what is our measure of success? Surely we are not in Iraq for the purpose of reducing violence, which has happened since the surge, but for the purpose of reducing violence between Sunnis and Shiites, who were not at each other's throats, at least not violently at each other's throats, in 2003. Now, so we must have some other definition of success. Now, Senator McCain has defined success in Iraq as an Iraq that is a democratic ally, and that's very similar to President Bush's definition of victory, which is a democratic, united, and stable Iraq. Is Iraq democratic? Can it be democratic? Is it united? Can it be united? And is it an ally? Can it be an ally?
How do you answer those questions?
My answer is that, first, it is not democratic. There have been democratic elections, but the people who have won the democratic elections in the Arab parts of Iraq are in the Shiite areas, and they, of course, are the people, the Shiites are a majority of the Iraqi population. They control the central government. These are religious parties committed to making Iraq into a Shiite Islamic state, and who, in the parts of Iraq that they control, which is the southern half of the country and the eastern part of Baghdad, including Sadr City, have already created a Shiite theocratic state that is considerably more severe in the imposition of Islamic law and the suppression of dissenting points of view than that which exists in Iran. In the Sunni areas, we've had enormous progress since the surge. I would argue not mostly because of the surge, but because we created a Sunni army, the Awakening, now 100,000 strong, that fought and made great progress against al-Qaeda. But who are the leaders of the Awakening? They are the same people who, they're the tribal leaders, they're the same people who are running that part of Iraq and indeed much of the rest of Iraq on behalf of Saddam Hussein. They're the Ba'athists. Now, do we seriously believe that these Ba'athists have now had a democratic conversion? I don't think so. We don't hear, because they aren't challenged, and I find this a disappointing part of the debate, does Senator McCain really believe that Nouri al-Maliki is a Democrat, the Prime Minister of Iraq? This is a man who was a apparatchik of the Dawa Party. Dawa is the oldest of the Shiite Islamic parties. It was on the terrorism list until 2002. It participated in the bombing of the 1983 bombing of the U.S. Embassy in Kuwait. He has, in every regard, behaved as Prime Minister of Iraq as a sectarian politician. That's the democracy side, and I'll try and be brief. On the ally side, the two dominant parties in the Iraqi coalition are Dawa and what is now called the Supreme Iraqi Islamic Council. But its previous name, only recently changed, gives you a better idea of its approach. It's the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, and it is the largest of the parties. Now, SCIRI, second party, was founded in 1982. Where? Tehran. By whom? By the Ayatollah Khomeini. And it has been sponsored and supported by Iran and has consistently taken pro-Iranian positions. Maliki himself was in exile in Syria, but Dawa has also been supported by Iran. I believe when push comes to shove, we're going to find that this government of Iraq is much more on the side of Iran than it is on the side of the United States. I don't believe the Ba'athists can be have made a conversion to loving the United States. It's an alliance of convenience to be taking U.S. support. And finally, on the issue of stability, I don't find it to be a stable situation in Iraq, where you have a Shiite Iraqi army on the one hand, and a Sunni army, the Awakening, 100,000 strong, which is viewed by the Shiite government as being a Ba'athist fifth column, which in fact it is, and which sees, the Awakening sees the Shiite government as an Iranian proxy, which to some degree it is. And finally, I haven't mentioned the third part of Iraq, which is Kurdistan. It is in every regard an independent state. If you accept international recognition, if you went there, it has its own parliament, its own army. It prohibits the Iraqi army from going on its territory. It flies its own flag. And its people unanimously don't want to be part of Iraq.
Let me push you a little bit on the Shiite parties. Is it not true that in any relatively free election in Iraq, which took place in the beginning of 2005 and then another one later in the year, it was all but certain that the Shiite parties, which are granted they are theocratic parties to some degree, were going to win because the Shia are the majority in Iraq. They were also second-class citizens and downtrodden for many years, if not centuries. Wasn't it likely that the Shia were going to vote for these parties? And why is that then necessarily anti-democratic and playing necessarily into the hands of Iran? Because many argue in both Iran and in Iraq that the Iraqi Shia are more moderate than the Iranian Shia, or that they are the Iranians who are in power in Tehran.
Well, first, I absolutely think that there's justice in this outcome, in these elections. The Iraqi Shia were suppressed from the day of Iraq's founding when the British decided that instead of having a democracy, that they would install a recently unemployed Sunni prince, Faisal, who had been, the French had kicked out of Syria, and they made him the king of Iraq. Of course, since the Sunnis were only 20% of Iraq, he ruled by creating a Sunni army, a Sunni bureaucracy, and that was what kept the Sunnis on top, the Shiites down, and the Kurds in until 2003, when we went in and unintentionally wiped all that away and paved the way for the Shiites to come to power through what I think were fair elections. I don't quarrel with the justice of that, but I do question whether it served the interest of the United States. And my book's about the interest of the United States. It's not about the interest of the Iraqis. Did it serve the interest of the United States for us to commit $700 billion, such a large part of our military, to do such damage to other national security interests, which I in the region and elsewhere, which I discuss in the book, for the purpose of allowing pro-Iranian theocratic, Shiite theocratic parties to come to power in Iraq, even if they came to power democratically? That's really my point. I don't quarrel with that the Shiites, the suppression of the Shiites reinforced their identity as Shiites, much more important than their Iraqi identity. But did that serve the U.S. interest to enable these parties to come to power?
I'll get to the questions about the U.S. interest in a minute, but I want to follow with another question about a notion of victor and unintended consequences in Iraq. You write that Iran is the victor in Iraq. Is that necessarily bad?
Yes.
Why?
Well, under current circumstances, bad for the United States. We've had a hostile relationship with Iran, very hostile one, for 30 years. It is a country that is acquiring nuclear capability, whether it wishes to convert. It is acquiring the capability to make fissile material. It is an open question as to whether it wants to weaponize that at this point in time. It is, at least its current president, is erratic, very hostile to the state of Israel.
But he wasn't president all the time, and there have been far more moderate leaders.
Just let me continue. And so for Iran now to have its closest allies in the world is the government of Iraq. And sitting in control of the South, which is where 80% of Iraq's oil reserves are, I don't think that is a positive development. Now, do I believe that we could have a different relationship with Iran? Yes, I think that's possible, not guaranteed. And one of the things I discuss in the book is how we might get there.
Well, there is a lot of talk about achieving stability in Iraq and achieving stability in the wider Middle East, and I think that you write that that shouldn't be what the United States should be fighting for in Iraq. But nevertheless, striving for stability is a decent goal for many. Isn't it possible that a good relationship between Iran and Iraq helps to contribute to stability in that part of the world, given the very rancorous and violent relationship that existed between Iran and Iraq before?
There's no question about that. Obviously, much of the current history is the result of the Iran-Iraq War, which lasted 8 years, killed 1 million people in the two countries, young men, the future of those societies, and which put Iraq in debt and to some degree led directly to Saddam Hussein's decision to invade Kuwait and all that has followed that has made the Iraq question front and center since 1990, for the last 18 years. So a good relationship between Iran and Iraq is a very desirable thing. That is different from a situation where the government of Iraq is a close ally of Iran, where Iran plays, as it does, a major role in the decisions of the Iraqi government, where the Iranian presence is a source of intense opposition to the Iraqi government by the Sunni population and a source of concern by the population of Kurdistan. But again, I come back to another point, which I think is fundamental. Even if there is greater stability because there is a because as a result of Iran's allies coming to power in Iraq, there is a much better relationship between Iran and Iraq. Was that something, was that outcome one that justified a $700 billion expenditure by the United States, the 4,000 dead and 40,000 casualties, and the enormous damage that's been done to American prestige and leadership in the world?
All right, so if Iraq is lost as far as the U.S., as far as the war is concerned.
As far as achieving our objectives.
All right. The war does continue. What do you see the United States fighting for now?
Well, I think the United States should get out. And the reason I think the United States should get out is that we have other more important challenges to our national security. Iraq is a diversion. The more important challenges... The Iranian nuclear program, North Korea's nuclear program, the war on terror, and that front, which is a combined front, which is Pakistan, Afghanistan, and perhaps top of the list, the Pakistan itself, which has been well embraced by this administration until Musharraf left. It was a rogue nation which was supplying nuclear technology to. Our enemies, North Korea, Iran, Libya, and that's clearly not the total list. That's just the ones that we know about. So as long as we're so focused on Iraq and we have so many of our resources committed there, we're not meeting our other challenges, security challenges. And so that's why I think it is in our interest to get out. Now, since I don't believe we can achieve the democratic, unified Iraq... but I do think there are things we can do on the way out. I'm not an advocate of the partition of Iraq, and I certainly don't think that's what the United States should be doing. My position is that Iraq has already broken up, and we should not have as our goal and commit our national resources to trying to put back together a country which... where a segment of the population, the Kurds, unanimously don't want to be part of it, never did, or where there are such fundamental differences in identity between the Sunnis and the Shiites. If we don't put it back together again, then I would argue that greater stability comes about by arrangements in which the Sunnis police themselves with the awakening, the Shiites run their part of the country, and the Kurds have Kurdistan. We can play a role by helping to demarcate the lines between the Kurds and the Arabs, because there's a lot of disputed territory there. And it's not clear whether the Sunnis and Shiites will each form regions, although they have that right under the Iraqi constitution. But you could also define spheres of influence, Sunni West Baghdad, Shiite East Baghdad, and in some of these other areas.
But when you talk about this arrangement, which you don't call partition, but which is...
Sorry, I just want to be clear. I don't advocate partition. I believe the arrangement is a partition arrangement, but my point is that this is the Iraqis who have partitioned the country, not something that the U.S. should be doing.
All right, well then let me just rephrase my question slightly. When you talk of a kind of partition that's already taken place in Iraq, you're not talking about three separate states, three separate formal states represented three times in the United Nations with separate embassies around the world and so on and so forth. You're talking about some kind of radically decentralized Iraqi state with a great deal of political and economic power devolved to the different regions.
Actually, I think it may be a mixture of both. First, the Iraqi constitution, which was adopted by 79% of the Iraqi people, basically... by 100% of the Kurds and 98% of the Shiites, opposed by almost all the Sunnis. But that constitution does create already a radically decentralized state. And if you want to read the constitution, just go online, read Article 110, Article 115, Article 121, and you understand the constitution. Article 110 says the central government, the federal government, will have the following exclusive powers. And that list is so short, it does not include taxes. It has no power to tax. It doesn't include, includes defense policy, but not actually control over the military, and weights and measures, so the kilometer in Basra is the same length as a kilometer in Kurdistan. That's about it. Article 115 says if it's not a power in Article 110, then it belongs to the regions, and regional law is superior to federal law. Article 121 says the regions can have offices in foreign embassies, they can have their own armies, they can amend the application of any federal law. So that is already the current arrangement. Now, what about the future? I think between the Kurdistan already exists, but I don't see that Kurdistan can be kept in Iraq indefinitely. I learned from my time in Croatia, in the former Yugoslavia, that where people in geographically defined area unanimously don't want to be part of a state, you just can't keep them in. The Kurds voted in January 2005 98% for independence. If you talk to any Kurd and ask, you say, oh, you call them an Iraqi, they're offended. There's nothing that's going to change that view. So I think sooner or later, sometime on my prediction in the next 10 years, you'll see an independent Kurdistan that will be a member of the United Nations, and I think that will be a just outcome. As between Sunnis and Shiites, my guess is that both of them would say they're Iraqis. They just don't have a common vision of what Iraq should be. And because they don't have the common vision, I think a decentralized common state is probably the best outcome. I don't think it's the most likely outcome. I think what's more likely is that the Shiites and the Sunnis will fight it out until one prevails, and that will almost certainly be the Shiites.
Hasn't that in effect been what the internal war has been about in Iraq during these years? Essentially, the Shia and the Sunni fighting for paramount control of the wider Iraq.
Well, of Arab Iraq, with the Kurds staying out. I think that's essentially right. But I express it a little differently. It is the sense that the Shiite, on the Shiite part, that they are the majority, that they've been repressed for 80 years in Iraq, and as a religion, they've been repressed by the Sunnis for 1,400 years, that this is their moment, that they are entitled by virtue of being a majority democratically to rule Iraq and to define Iraq in their terms. And a sense on the part of the Sunnis, who was the group that had supported Saddam, but many Sunnis did not support Saddam, but every Sunni, while even those who oppose Saddam, they do not accept that Iraq can be defined as a Shiite state. And they believe that they do see that the Shiites as being aligned with Iran, whom they see as the great national enemy. So there are really irreconcilable differences in identity, and that's the question that has to be resolved.
If there are these irreconcilable differences between the Sunni and the Shia, and you believe that for the United States, the Iraq war has been lost and that the United States should get out, where do you come down on the issue of what will happen afterwards? There are a great many arguments in the United States over the issue of renewed civil war, bloodbath. What is the American responsibility to Iraqis, Arab Iraqis? What do you think will happen if the United States does decide to pull out?
Well, I think it matters a great deal how we pull out. And I think we do have responsibilities. But I don't think that our responsibility, in terms of our own national interest, can mandate a indefinite, 100-year presence in Iraq. That isn't in our interest. I also don't believe that we are going to be capable of preventing preventing the renewed civil war if it's going to happen. I think it's very important to look at there's a very important development this summer, which I discuss in the book, and that was what happened when Senator Obama went to Baghdad. Now, before he went, Prime Minister Maliki gave an interview with a German news magazine. In that magazine, he said, well, we'd like to see the United States get out, and we think that Senator Obama has about the right time period. Well, that caused, as you might imagine, as you know, Mike, a consternation in the White House. And so they went to Ali al-Dabbagh, who was the Maliki's press spokesman, and said, you got to put out a statement. And Aldabaugh wrote a statement, or had one written for him, which said, the Prime Minister Maliki says he was misquoted. But Aldabaugh wouldn't put out the statement in his own name, so it was actually released by CENTCOM, by the American military. Then, and Spiegel, I think it was Spiegel, released the transcript of the interview, which showed, of course, Maliki had said what he said. He then met with Obama, and after the meeting, Maliki said Obama's timetable's about right, and Aldabaugh said yes, and this time he means it. Now, when that happened, much of the press and certainly all the neoconservatives said, oh, this is because Maliki has seen the handwriting on the wall. He thinks Obama's going to be president. He wants to make him good with the new president. And others said, oh, this is because Maliki is playing to Iraqi public opinion. And, of course, from the White House, there was all the grumbling about what an ungrateful man Maliki was. But the reality, the possibility that ought to have been considered is that Maliki meant it. And why did Maliki mean it? Well, it's very simple. From 2005 to 2007, he and the Iranians were very happy to have the Americans in Iraq because they were doing what? They were fighting the Sunnis. From 2007 on, the United States stopped fighting the Sunnis and started arming them and financing them. And from the point of view of Maliki, the Al-Qaeda, and we know that doesn't mean necessarily Osama bin Laden's organization, but these related Sunni fundamentalists, while they could kill thousands of Shiites, they were never a threat to take over the Iraqi government. But a 100,000 Sunni army led by Saddam's officers, supported by the people who used to run Iraq, that was a real threat. So why does Maliki want the U.S. out? Because as long as the U.S. is there, it's going to be supporting the awakening. It's going to be telling him they have to be included in the Iraqi army, which he doesn't want to do. When the U.S. is gone, he and his Iranian allies can deal with the awakening.
Let's talk about Iran for just a moment. The issue you write about, the issue of Iran's nuclear program, is one of the last questions in the debate this evening between Senators Obama and McCain. Without getting too technical, because there's a lot of technical issues involved, do you think Iran can be persuaded to modify its nuclear activities in order to assure the international community that it's not after the bomb?
I don't know. But I think we need to be thinking strategically about this question and not on wishful thinking or a lot of loud rhetoric. I was interested in McCain's assertion of or his citation of Teddy Roosevelt to speak softly and carry a big stick, because it's the Bush administration that's been speaking loudly and having no stick, particularly with regard to Iran. It's totally unacceptable for Iran to have nuclear weapons or a nuclear program, and then they've done nothing. Absolutely nothing.
Interestingly, Obama essentially said the same thing in his answer, and it puts him in a difficult position if he's elected.
Yes, but I think he has some opportunities, and here's why. Let's look at our options. There is a military option, and frankly, I think the military option could work. That is to say, although people talk about these nuclear facilities being dispersed, some of them buried underground, the fact is we probably know where enough of them are that we could bomb them continuously. And although we might not destroy all of them, and we certainly may not destroy the equipment, which is easily hidden away, the fact is scientists and engineers and construction workers are not going to go to places that are being bombed. So as long as we're prepared to have a continual bombing campaign, we probably can indefinitely delay Iran's nuclear program. The problem with that option is the consequences. One of them is Iran's ability with its Shiite allies in Iraq to retaliate against U.S. troops there. That's an argument. We'll have more options if we withdraw from Iraq. The other is, of course, its ability to the effect on oil supplies that will make us all deeply nostalgic for those happy days of $4 a gallon gasoline, better than the $40 a gallon gasoline. So given that the military option would have potentially catastrophic consequences, what is the alternative? and that is a diplomatic one. It's no alternative to just talk and say it's unacceptable. And so, yes, I think that would include negotiation. Now,
let me be a little bit more specific, because I've had some experience reporting on this issue. The Iranians have been made, this current Iranian government has been making the argument that for a number of years, that it cannot trust the international community or any other nations to supply it with the nuclear fuel that it wants in order to power civilian nuclear power plants, which haven't been built yet, by the way, but which Iran believes should be built in the future. So they say no one is reliable, not even Russia, and Russia has offered to jointly produce nuclear fuel. How does diplomacy handle that one?
Well, I think it's important to look at what are Iran's motivations here. It is possible that they want nuclear technology for power generation. It's possible that they want nuclear technology so that they have the option to make a nuclear bomb, so that at some point in the future, they have a stockpile of they master the process by which they could enrich uranium. And of course, the third possibility is that they want a nuclear bomb. Is it possible to think of a deal that might keep them short of developing a bomb? In the book, I talk about an Iranian non-paper that was presented in May of 2003, in which they proposed a bargain in which they would agree to very intrusive international inspections. They wanted a reliable supply of and some access to enrichment technology, but I think we're open to all sorts of ways this could be done that would satisfy the international community. They promised that they would stop supporting Hamas and Hezbollah for operations inside Israel proper. They would cooperate against Al-Qaeda, and in return they wanted to be taken off the axis of evil, lifting of economic sanctions, and for the U.S. to stop supporting the Mujahideen-e Khalq, which they consider a terrorist group. The Bush administration, full of mission accomplished, dismissed this offer out of hand. Nonetheless, I think it is possible to construct a deal with Iran along similar lines. Why? Because there are two reasons why Iran might want nuclear weapons. First, for security, deterrent of U.S. attack and to enhance its military position. But the fact is that the U.S. is not going to attack Iran if it does not have nuclear weapons. Certainly one of the great lessons of Iraq is that all the trouble we had in Iraq, a country one-third the size of Iran, where a large part of the population welcomed the U.S. invasion, we're certainly not going to be trying to bite off the same thing in Iran. But if they have a nuclear weapon or program, that does risk an attack. And secondly,
well, but they also at the same time see the North Korean example, where the North Koreans have acquired the bomb, well, and an attack from the United States seems much less likely.
It was unlikely even before the bomb, because the North Koreans had the ability to launch conventional weapons onto Seoul. That's always been the dilemma. But the other problem for Iran with nuclear weapons is actually, I think, what Senator McCain referred to in the debate, which is, if they get a nuclear weapon, clearly the Saudis, the Kuwaitis, the UAE are going to be on the list of countries, the Egyptians, that would also want to go nuclear. Right now, Iran has an overwhelming position in terms of manpower, military might in the Gulf. That would disappear. Nuclear weapons would be the great equalizer. So from its own security perspective, this is not really necessarily a very good thing for them. The other reason that they may want a nuclear weapon is prestige. This is something that countries want. Now, is it possible to construct a bargain with the Iranians in which we provide them with an element of respect, we include them in a regional security system, we stop the name-calling? And the top of their list in 2003 was to take us off the axis of evil. What was the axis of evil? It was a ridiculous historical comparison that a Bush speechwriter came up, which compared the Rome-Berlin axis to the Tehran-Baghdad axis, Rome and Berlin being allies in the Second World War, and Saddam and the Iran of the Ayatollahs being bitter enemies. But that was what they wanted. So I think it is possible to have a relationship with Iran in which the country, not Ahmadinejad, but the country is accorded respect, and which might then, as part of a bargain, get them to freeze, slow down their nuclear program. One very important point, which actually you refer to, Mike, in your question in a way, is they repeatedly say they don't want nuclear weapons. And in my experience as a negotiator, it's a lot easier to get people to come up to an agreement with their public position, even if they had a really a secret different position. If they once they cross the line and say, we do want a nuclear weapon, then it's going to be very tough to negotiate.
In the last chapter, you call the last chapter, I think, an effective national security policy. And what's interesting about it is that you spent time in the Senate as a staffer and in the executive branch as a diplomat. Now you're out of government, as far as I know. And you paint a very dismal picture of what U.S. foreign policy is and how it's made. Among the things that you cite, ineffective policies, poor priorities, poor intelligence, lack of knowledge, reliance on conventional wisdom, no innovative thinking. And you also say the less said about the freedom agenda, the better. I think that's a very interesting remark given the history of American foreign policy during this Bush administration. You say what you would like to see in an ideal American foreign policy and national security policy, but you don't say much in your book about how to get there. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, I think this election will provide a way in which the American people can make a choice as to how to get there. But my basic argument in this book, which is not a Democratic or Republican argument, I hope it appeals to both, to liberals and conservatives, it is that we need to be strategic in what we're doing. And by what do I mean by that? I mean we need to be focused on the results. Gene Kirkpatrick, criticizing Jimmy Carter's human rights policy, said it was the kind of policy that made us, the U.S., feel good, but it didn't do good. I didn't agree with her criticism, but I like the line. We've had in the Bush administration policies that make them feel good, but haven't done good for the U.S. If we want an effective national security policy, we have to prioritize. If we are concerned, and I think we should be, about rogue states with weapons of mass destruction, let's prioritize weapons of mass destruction. Nuclear is by far the most dangerous. Chemical weapons are great against defenseless Kurdish villagers. They aren't that much of a threat to us. So that ought to have been our top priority. Iraq clearly didn't have a nuclear program. Once the inspectors were in 2003, you can't possibly hide a nuclear facility from that kind of inspection. Iran and North Korea did. That's where that ought to, and Pakistan, those ought to have been our priorities. You need hard-headed analysis of the problem. We had wishful thinking that the Iraqi Shiites would become American allies because we had liberated them with no understanding of what had happened in 1991 when we had encouraged the Shiites to rebel and then allowed Saddam to repress them. The architects of this war didn't even think about that. But there was a huge amount of wishful thinking. So I want hard-headed analysis.
I'm sorry, I just want to
go through a couple of points. Intelligence. The fact is that intelligence, we pay $30 billion a year. I'm pulling the figure out of the air. If I actually knew the CIA budget, it would be a secret. But it's about that.
That figure, yes.
Yeah. For the intelligence, so naturally, any bit of information we get on intelligence, and I've been in the policy circles, that's treated like pure gold. You can have a discussion, as I did, about what Serb intentions might be during the Balkans War, and somebody say, well, the intel says this. And that was intended to shut off the conversation. But, of course, the intel was based on some intercept or some the secretary to some leader who was on our payroll, whereas you could form observations by going to Serb-held territory, talking to their leaders as to what their intentions were. Intelligence, the way we rely on intelligence, which is so often wrong, it becomes a crutch instead of overall analysis and understanding of the country. So I think that's another way to make our foreign policy more effective. And the freedom agenda, I think this is a great country. I agree with Senator Obama and Senator McCain. But when we go around the world, you know, if you're really wonderful, you don't have to go around telling everybody you're really wonderful. You know, I mean, this is just in our ordinary life. I mean, it's much better to have other people saying how wonderful you are. And if you live abroad, Mike, and you know this full well, other people are not impressed when Americans go around and say, tell them how wonderful Americans are. It just doesn't work. Other peoples don't imagine that they're incapable of freedom. So I'm in favor of supporting democracy. I just wouldn't be proclaiming it the way we do.
The problem is that our political system is so polarized now and has been for such a long time that it makes it almost impossible, or it seems that it's almost impossible, to get hard-headed analysis. For those who favor hard-headed analysis and a clear-eyed look at intelligence to prevail. The argument is so rancorous in America today that some put those who want a hard-headed analysis on the defensive simply by asserting that that's what they want. And getting there seems nearly impossible, or as impossible as it's ever been in American contemporary life.
Yes, it's very difficult. But if people like me don't, who have a lot of experience inside the system, don't lay it out, then nobody will. And I hope that my book is not a case of tilting at windmills. I hope that it will resonate, and you've really picked up on what I consider some of the most important lessons from this book. And this is why, another point that you cited, this is why we also need more outliers, more people within government who are prepared to challenge the conventional wisdom.
And it seems to me we need leaders as well who are prepared to encourage outliers to challenge the conventional wisdom.
Well, of course we do, but frankly, the people that I would fault in all this are the people who are at the level that I was, as ambassadors, assistant secretaries, the four-star generals. They have often a very clear idea as to how things really work, and yet, having worked their way up to that point in their careers, then they don't really feel that they don't use the position that they now have to challenge a lot of the conventional wisdom out of the political leadership. The famous case of General Shinseki, the chief of the army, who, I mean, it's a wonderful story of how the thinking is different. As I'm sure most of you know, he was asked in a congressional hearing how many troops it would take to stabilize Iraq. And he said, several hundred thousand, by which he meant 300,000 or 400,000. Now, he was a military man giving a professional judgment, but it was interpreted by Paul Wolfowitz and Rumsfeld as a political statement undermining the case for war, because their case for war was that it would be easy. Now, Shinseki, however, didn't really follow up on that comment. He was chastised by Wolfowitz in a very crude way. The fact is that Colin Powell knew that Shinseki was right. Almost every other of the senior military, except Tommy Franks, the commander who was planning the Iraq War, knew that Shinseki was right. None of them spoke up. Shinseki didn't pursue his case. I think all of them did a great disservice to the enlist to the men and women of our armed services and to our country. And I've seen, I don't mean to single out the military. I've seen this with ambassadors. I've seen this with assistant secretaries. To take another example of it, which was, again, part of the debate, in Afghanistan? Why are we in this mess? It's because in the 1980s, we embarked on a campaign to support the so-called freedom fighters against the Soviets. We thought of the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan in 1979 as part of this. It certainly was an evil act, but as part of an aggressive empire, yep, terribly threatening that was going to gobble up Afghanistan en route to grabbing ports in Iran and Pakistan. Well, that it turned out that that aggressive Soviet Union was a country that was that wasn't even didn't had 12 years to live. It obviously wasn't the power. And there were plenty of Soviet scholars and plenty of people in government who had been in the Soviet Union, knew full well it wasn't the kind of power it was portrayed to be, and that this was the invasion of Afghanistan was a defensive reaction by a geriatric and failing leadership. We then proceeded to arm the freedom fighters, as they were called, who in fact were fundamentalists who hated the United States. The people involved in that operation knew very well who was being funded. Instead of channeling some of the funding to more moderate elements, they let this Islamist prime minister, president of Pakistan, General Zia-ul-Haq, use the funding to support the most radical elements in Afghanistan, as he was also Islamicizing Pakistan, which had not been a Islamic country. And then more or less the same pattern was repeated in this decade, and the people within the government didn't challenge this.
Another example of unintended consequences.
Absolutely.
Well, there's lots to talk about in your book. There are things that we didn't cover, but I think it's time to get the audience involved and open it up for questions. This young man over here. Yep.
Thank you for a very interesting talk. I'm curious, can you expound a bit in general about the future of Iraq and specifically Kurdistan with regards to Turkey?
This book follows on a book I wrote 2 years ago called The End of Iraq, which outlines this three-state solution and which talks at length about Kurdistan. And one of the questions I got as I talked about that book, it was always this question, what about Turkey? So there's a whole chapter in this book about Turkey, and it deals very significantly with the Kurdish question in Turkey. Maybe I shouldn't answer this because I don't want to preempt you from buying the book. Oh, well, okay. But the short answer is that there are, while there are 6 million Kurds in Iraq, 8 million, 8 to 10 in Iran, there are 14 to 18 million in Turkey. But the situation of the Kurds in Turkey is very different. They're not demanding independence. Even the PKK are arguing for civil rights and respect for language rights.
The PKK being the more radical Kurdish group.
Which has bases in northern Iraq and which has staged attacks even recently on Turkey. And I think most Turkish Kurds, or very few, would like an independent Kurdistan, first because there's no realistic prospect it could happen, second because many Kurds have moved to western Turkey because jobs are there. Istanbul is the largest Kurdish city in the world. And because Turkey sooner or later will be part of the European Union, and much better to be part of that than to be a landlocked state in what was southeast Turkey. And as Turkey has become more confident internally, it has adopted a more sophisticated approach to Iraqi Kurdistan. There are actually good relations between the Iraqi Kurds and Turkey. Turkey, incidentally, facilitated the protection of Iraqi Kurdistan from 1991 on. And it was President Özal who pushed for this safe area to protect the Kurds after their failed uprising against Saddam Hussein. Turkey is today the most important source of foreign investment in Iraqi Kurdistan. Even General Kenan Evren, who was the military dictator of Turkey in the early 80s, made himself president. He's the guy who launched the crackdown on the Kurds in Turkey. He said recently, what are we complaining about an independent Kurdistan in northern Iraq? It already exists. We have to get used to it. And there are many Kurds, there are a growing number of Turks, I don't want to overstate this, who say, maybe it's better for us to have an independent Kurdistan which is secular, pro-Western, aspiring to be democratic, and which would be dependent on us, that might be a better neighbor than a pro-Iranian Islamic Iraq.
Yes, right here. Wait for the mic. It'll come quick.
Your mention of the possible partition, or at least the question of partition of Iraq, is interesting because everything you said about the state of Iraq didn't seem to suggest there's much of an argument left for keeping it together. And I think it seems, at least to me, that the state of affairs in Iraq over the last 8 years calls into question the whole creation of Iraq in the beginning with the British. So what and whose interest is it to maintain Iraq between the Sunnis and the Shia? And also, I'm curious where the natural resources lie vis-a-vis these sectarian groups.
Well, there is in the world, and this is a cornerstone of U.S. foreign policy, an instinctive reliance or instinctive approach to preserve the integrity of every existing state. And the Bush administration has defined the unity of Iraq as one of our major objectives. And nobody sits there and says, why? What is there about this country which has been such a dismal failure for most of its people that we feel we should hold it together? But remember back in 1991, the current president's father went to Kiev in August of 1991 and warned the Ukrainians against excessive nationalism. It was known as the Chicken Kiev speech. By the end of the year, Ukraine was an independent state. And we had the same tragic approach to trying to hold Yugoslavia together when we should have been focused on... Well, that was impossible. We should have been focused on trying to prevent the war. Both Shiites and Sunnis are Iraqi nationalists, and so neither group wants to break up the country, but neither group accepts that the other has a legitimate... They don't want to share power with the other. They are probably both opposed to an independent Kurdistan, but there is an acknowledgement that Kurdistan is separate. So I think a velvet divorce, like between the Czechs and the Slovaks, is possible there. With regard to the resources, about 80% of Iraq's reserves and two-thirds of its production is in the Shiite south around Basra, and the other third of its production, then maybe 20% of its reserves, are in Kirkuk, which is contested between the Kurds and the Arabs. And the conventional wisdom is the Sunnis don't have oil and gas. But the fact is that Iraq has never had much exploration for oil and gas because its problem was never how do we find more? It was how do we stay within our OPEC quota? So they simply produced from the easiest, cheapest place. That was the South. And most experts believe there's probably significant resources in the Sunni areas as well. They're largely unexplored.
Other questions? Yes, this woman right there.
Hi, I'm curious to know how you would apply your perspective on Iraq to other areas in the world, particularly Kashmir. I wonder if perhaps you think it'd be in the United States' interest to try to negotiate some sort of mutually acceptable settlement there, and maybe that would entice the Pakistanis to be a little more cooperative when it comes to hunting al-Qaeda. Any chance of that?
I'm glad you asked that question, because I have a whole chapter in the book on separatism and nation building. And what I argue is that, I look back at the last 20 years and I point out that virtually every international conflict that we have dealt with, every crisis, with the exceptions of Cambodia and Haiti, have involved issues of nationalism, separatism. I mean, what is the war in Iraq? It is between Sunnis and Shiites with the Kurds wanting to go their own way. What were we preoccupied with in the 1990s? It was the breakup of Yugoslavia. A place, I mean, how many Americans in 1990 had heard of Bosnia and Herzegovina? And, well, very few. And yet that became all of a sudden front and center. And actually,
how many Americans have heard of South Ossetia and Abkhazia in Georgia?
Right, and so you have, what is the problem in Georgia is the separatist aspirations of South Ossetia and Abkhazia. We can look at Indonesia, where there's Aceh and Papua, but potentially many more separatist movements. And Africa, South Sudan will become independent in a few years, presumably. Somaliland is already de facto independent, this northern coast of Somalia. And there are other countries that have the same potential to break up. Now, how do we approach that? Do we always try to hold these places together? In some cases, that's the right thing to do. But in other cases, it seems to me our focus should be in accepting the right of people to self-determination, and then trying to mitigate the consequences, the violence that often accompanies that process. Now, coming to Kashmir, which is an obvious case, this is a territory that has been disputed between India and Pakistan since 1947. The oldest dispute that's still under the purview of the United Nations, the longest-lasting UN mission. Older than most of the people of Kashmir, much older. The fact is that at least in the valley, the center part, most of the people there would prefer an independent state. They don't want to be part of India or Pakistan. They've been fought over both of them. Can we find some solution to Kashmir? Can we, which might respect those desires, and independence doesn't need to necessarily mean membership of the United Nations, some condominium. There are all sorts of great autonomy of the valley within India, but with special ties to Pakistan. There are all sorts of solutions that can be arranged to these kinds of problems. But I think it requires a lot of creativity and a recognition that we cannot indefinitely force people to live in countries they don't want to be part of.
Another question. Raised hands. Two more? How about down here in the front?
I'm so interested to hear you say that there's this whole level of people, ambassadors and secretaries and so on, that have insight and information and knowledge that they seem intimidated to share, and that this knowledge could be so, the consequences could be so important. Why? Do they allow this to happen? Is it simply a matter of they're going to lose their jobs? And can you imagine an environment in which those people could have, a way to be heard?
I think the ethos of public service so often involves people spending their careers to try to get to advance through different positions, ultimately ending up in the military with a flag rank, general or admiral, and at the top, the four stars, diplomatic service, becoming an ambassador, an assistant secretary, undersecretary. And that process is one where you want to be a team player. And that inevitably involves going with the conventional wisdom. I think what we really need is a different ethos of public service, and it's this. It isn't focused on what job I ended up with or what title, but what I did. What did I accomplish? What difference did I make? And I think if we had that ethos, then we would have more people willing to speak out. But we also, of course, need political leaders who are going to be tolerant of people who forcefully express their point of view, who challenge their view of the conventional wisdom. And we'll need somebody who will tell President Obama or President McCain, let's pipe down on this freedom agenda business. Yes, we should be supporting democracy, but let's stop going around the world acting like we know it all and nobody else knows anything. That's a tough sell when you have both candidates rightly describing the United States as the greatest country in the world. But that seems to me is what we need, people willing to do that. And we need leaders who are willing to hear that advice. And even if they don't take it, to appreciate and reward the people who offer those that kind of advice.
Last question, right here.
Going back to Iraq and its relevancy to the self-interest of the United States, why did Bush attack Iraq? Or if I can ask the question another way, if we leave Iraq, what do we lose?
Well, I'd like to, before I answer that, just to make a point here, which is that I argue that the Iraq war, as a result of this war, most Iraqis are much better off. Most Iraqis, 80% of them, are Kurds or Shiites. Kurds are much closer to their dream of independence, and the Shiites, who are brutally repressed, are now in control of the government, and they've been able to freely express their desire for these for a Shiite religious government. It is the United States that is worse off, and what I would argue is that all the bad consequences of losing have already taken place. If we withdraw from Iraq, this isn't going to be like Vietnam. We're not going to see Osama bin Laden striding through the gates of the Republican Palace. If we withdraw from Iraq, what we're going to see is Iran's closest allies being the government of Iraq and coordinating closely and with the Iranian ambassador calling the shots. Well, that's exactly what's going on now, and I describe this in the book. If we withdraw, we're going to have the Baathists back in power in the Sunni areas. That's the situation now. There are ways in which things could go worse, and that's what we need to guard against. We do not want to see the awakening dismantled. So that, although that's what the Iraqi government wants, we don't want to see it because the awakening is fighting Al-Qaeda, which is a real threat to us. The Baathists are merely unattractive. Al-Qaeda's a threat. But surely it's not a victory. It's a loss. It's a loss to the United States that Iran's allies are in power in the center and the Baathists are in power in the Sunni areas. I can envision scenarios when we could lose even worse. Not that the terrorists would win in Baghdad, but that Al-Qaeda could come back.
Well, Peter, let me thank you on behalf of the library and the Aloud program. Terrific discussion, particularly for this night. Thanks.
I thank you very much.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arendt Fox. Additional support is provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, City National Bank, KPMG, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by David Ornette Cherry.